However picturesque the ships may be, we have no need for them here, and so they do not exist. Boats of all sorts we do have, but not of the description that I have just mentioned. And we do not have unpleasant factory buildings spoiling the beautiful riverside scenery. Instead, we have magnificent edifices built of spirit world materials such as you are already familiar with, reposing along the waterside, with spacious embankments and splendidly laid out gardens through which the river threads its placid way, slowly, very slowly, and calmly. When I first saw one of the spirit world rivers, so slowly was it moving that to my unaccustomed eyes I felt sure that it was not moving at all. But it is possible to see the movement and to feel it. You can have no conception how glorious it is to glide along such a river in some graceful boat, passing through the rolling banks of flowers upon either hand, or through some peaceful meadow where the trees reflect their shapely forms in the tranquil waters, or again, to draw alongside some beautiful broad marble steps, to go ashore, mount to a greater height and view the ribbon of scintillating color that the river reveals itself to be from this higher elevation, or, yet again, to proceed up some sequestered backwater to find one's self in the midst of a friend's garden. Nothing can possibly convey to you the brilliance of the color, always the color, that seems to abound in such full measure in the neighborhood of the rivers. Perhaps it is that the streams themselves reflect back so much colorful light from the flowers that this effect of seeming preponderance of color is produced. Whatever it may be, we all feel the same about it, and for that reason the rivers always have a very great attraction to the folk in their leisure moments. The water is of the purest, as you know, but its most remarkable feature, in the opinion of so many of us here, is the ability it has of changing its colors and shades of colors. At times, I have seen the river which runs near my home to be nothing less in appearance than a ribbon of molten gold. All the different hues that are usually reflected in a thousand different ways appeared to have vanished and in their place was liquid gold. At other times I have seen it shining as though of burnished silver. This rather unusual phenomenon puzzled me considerably in my early days here. But my invaluable friend, Edwin, soon instructed me in such matters as these. The explanation was simple enough. It was just that some visitant from higher realms was, or had been, in the neighborhood, and the influence which he brought with him was being reflected in the mirror surface of the water. As the influence became absorbed into the immediate surroundings, the river gradually resumed its customary appearance. I only mention this small incident to show you how these realms of the spirit world are ever affording us some delight or another, unasked, which makes the enjoyment of it still more precious to us. Akin to the rivers of the spirit world are, of course, the seas. They are like the seas of the earth merely as a body of water, but in no other respect. The waters of the rivers here, and the seas into which they flow, are of the same elements, that is to say, the water is what is known on earth as fresh water. As far as I was able to observe, I could not trace the presence of any salt in the sea. In general appearance, there is not a great deal of difference between the rivers and the ocean. Each has the same brilliance of color, but the rivers, by virtue of the fairly close proximity of their banks, with the large masses of flowers and the elegant buildings which adorn them, will have more colors to reflect in their surfaces, and so they will appear to be more colorful. But it must not be presumed that the sea lacks a full measure of color. Very far from it. No water, wherever situated here, lacks color. And the sea is never empty of the signs of life. There are always vessels of one sort or another to be seen sailing upon it or riding at anchor. In addition, however far one may travel, one is scarcely ever out of sight of an enchantingly lovely island, upon which one is at liberty to wander to one's heart's content, and enjoy the special features which all these islands possess. One of the islands, of which I have spoken to you before, contains a veritable paradise of bird life, where some of the most beautiful specimens of birds in all the glory of their gorgeous plumage are to be seen at close hand. They are not segregated and confined in cages, of course, but they are free to pursue their life in their natural element, the air, or to remain upon the ground in the absolute certainty of their complete security from harm. Consequently, they are the friends of any of us who may visit their special domain. This particular island is another favorite pleasure spot with us, and often do we go there to sit on the soft grass while birds of every description of vivid plumage and of every size come gathering round us, not for food, as one would imagine on earth, but just to demonstrate their knowledge that no harm can come to them, and to express their friendliness with all mankind in these realms. We are such regular visitors there that we know a great many of the birds by sight and by name, for someone is bound to give them names. Of course, bird life is not confined solely to this one island. Indeed, the birds are flying about throughout these and other realms. Just as with you on Earth, so are they here with us abroad and everywhere. I have not visited all the seas of the spirit world, but there is plenty of time yet. My visitations to the seaside have been chiefly to that ocean which is nearest to our particular quarter of these realms. When viewed from an elevation that is fairly high above sea level, the water presents a scintillating expanse of color. There are no storms to agitate the surface violently. At the same time, the sea is not always of a glassy smoothness. The gentlest of breezes will play lightly upon the waters, rippling the surface and forming little waves which take on 100 tints in the smallest space, so that these rays of reflected light are for all the world like the flashes of color that are to be seen issuing from the purest of diamonds. It is a thrilling experience to behold for the first time this glittering effect that is natural to all water in the spirit world. When I first beheld it, I could hardly believe my eyes, so unbelievably inspiring was the spectacle. And even now, although I have become to some extent a seasoned resident of these realms, I can still be thrilled by the interplay of color whenever I come within sight of river or lake or sea. And that applies to all of us here. Familiarity has not made us indifferent. There would be something radically wrong with ourselves if it did. There are many fine vessels to be seen upon all the waters of these regions, many of them the homes of residents. Ownership of such boats, in fact, of any boat, is governed by the same law that applies to all ownership in spirit lands, the law that makes it a sine qua non that all our possessions must be earned before we can own them. As far as the smaller craft are concerned, the type which would be known as private river craft on Earth, many people have such boats and spend their leisure moments upon the water, just as you do on Earth, but without any of the restrictions or dangers, even, that are to be encountered on Earth. It is perfectly safe here for a small child to sail out in a boat entirely alone. What is the difference, you might wish to ask, between country life and town life in the spirit world? In the form in which that question is framed, there is doubtless the impression that life in the spirit world consists of a regularly recurring series of episodes, or functions, dividing life into a number of compartments, as it were, though the compartments themselves might be contiguous. That is how life is composed, more or less, upon Earth. So to answer that question, I must place one or two considerations before you. Your life upon Earth is dominated by two factors at least, both of which are unavoidable. They are the need for rest through sleep, and the need for food. To maintain your life at all upon Earth, you must provide for these two requirements. As you know, in the spirit world we need neither physical rest nor food. Your life is therefore punctuated by recurring periods of sleeping and eating. A certain part of your life is spent with darkness upon Earth, and although you may illuminate the darkness with artificial light, the darkness still remains elsewhere. In these realms, as you know, too, we have no darkness at all, at any time. Our life, then, is one of absolute continuity in perpetual natural light. We have no blank period in our physical life such as you have during your sleep. We are forever awake. We carry on with our work until such time as we wish to stop, and then we stop. We can follow on with other work of a different nature, or we can betake ourselves to some form of amusement or entertainment, or we can indulge in our own particular pastime. At the conclusion of the latter, or at such time as we see fit, we will resume our work. Further, we live in a state of perpetual summer. We have no long summer or long winter evenings alternating. You have no possible means of experiencing these various factors upon earth because they do not and cannot exist there. You must therefore call your imagination into play and try to picture to yourself the particular conditions which I have just outlined to you. You should then be able to see that there is really no difference between town and country life in the spirit world. The cities of the earth are mere concentrations for reasons of commercial convenience. There being no commerce in the spirit world, we have no need for such concentrations. But what has been done is to place all the great halls of learning of these particular realms in one locality. There is no pressing need that they should be so disposed. With equal facility they could have been distributed throughout a wide area of these regions. But it was felt that a number of magnificent buildings, such as are the halls of learning, would present a much more imposing appearance if they were arranged in an orderly plan, each within a moderately close distance of the other. We can think of no better arrangement. And so the buildings were erected, many aeons ago. They occupy an immense area of ground, and each is standing in gardens and grounds of peerless beauty. Exactly in the center of this group of buildings is a temple of unsurpassed grandeur. It forms the hub of the city, and from it radiate all other buildings of whatever nature. We have no streets as you know them, for we do not require them, but we have broad, spacious thoroughfares of the softest grass upon which to walk. There is no traffic of vehicles here, so that there is no necessity for special pavements upon each side of the roadway, as you have for your own security. Sometimes these broad walks are paved with some of the wonderful stone creations of these realms, but more often they are covered with grass. When you come to view the countryside here, you find that without hedges and walls and other boundary marks, the whole landscape becomes one vast expanse of parklands interspersed with rivers and streams and wooded land. Standing amid all these beauties are the dwellings of the inhabitants of these regions of the spirit world, and in a part of the countryside there stands what we call the city. Where one ends and the other begins, it would be difficult to say. There are no municipal or civic rights to be considered, no parochial boundaries to be thought of. No suburban or rural privileges to intervene in any way. The city is part of the countryside. The countryside is part of the city. The life of one is the life of the other, simply because of the continuity of existence in the spirit world, and because of the perpetual daytime and perpetual summertime. There is no hot and stuffy city to make a visit into the country air so pressing. There is no great commercial attraction of the city to draw folk towards that center. So that, in effect, the country and the city are one. I promised, a little while since, that I would speak to you upon the subject of thought. Now, I think, would be a favorable opportunity to do so, leaving for the time such other matters of spirit life that are worthy of discussion. Spirit personality. When the spirit world is described as being a world of thought, where thought is the great creative power, and where thought is concrete and perceivable by all men, the conclusion is very often erroneously drawn that the spirit world is an unsubstantial place, and that we, its inhabitants, are vague shadowy people, lacking any real substance, and answering for all purposes to that very earthly designation of ghosts. Pursuing this mistaken deduction, the life of the spirit world people must inevitably be somewhat dreamlike and elusive. The incarnate think along these lines because to them thought is something that can be practiced unseen and heard. On earth thought is secret to their thinker until such time as he wishes to give verbal or other expression to his thoughts. It is customary to say on earth, our thoughts are our own, we can think what we like, thoughts can never harm anyone, and so on. So that when we of the spirit world assert that our world is a world of thought, the incarnate immediately revert to their own thoughts and their unsubstantial nature, and thereupon place the spirit world in the same category of tenuous things. Generally speaking, upon earth thought must have some form of concrete expression for it to be effective. The architect must first think of his cathedral, or whatever it may, commit his thoughts to paper in regular order and with exactitude before the builder can make any commencement upon the outward and visible expression of his original thoughts. And so it is with a multitude of other things, from the simplest article to the most complicated instrument or ornate building. On earth, thought must have a medium of some sort before it can find the slightest trace of outward expression. For this reason, among others, the incarnate are prone to regard the earth as being the one certain and substantial world in which it is possible to exist. The spirit world becomes the very opposite. The incarnate do not realize the force and power of thought, or else they would never think along such lines as I have indicated. Every thought that passes with force and purpose through the mind of an earth dweller is projected from his mind as a thought form. To speak unscientifically, it is registered, at least for a time, upon the surrounding ether. It depends, of course, upon the thought itself, and of what it consists. If it is merely one of those passing thoughts that all folk upon earth have in their minds at various moments during the day, then such thoughts will be registered in the manner I have just indicated. If the thought is directed towards some friend who is now resident in the spirit world, that thought, if it is properly directed with purpose and intent, will inevitably reach that friend. It will reach him or her just as it is sent, no more and no less, good or bad or indifferent. Thought may be invisible to the majority of earth dwellers, but it is very much visible to spirit folk. People who are still on earth, and whose psychic powers have been developed, are often capable of seeing these thought forms. That ability raises problems which sometimes lead to mistakes and misunderstandings. Thought is upon a different plane, a higher plane of existence from that organ of the earthly body, the brain, through which thought functions on earth. Thought is upon the same plane of existence as the mind, and the mind belongs truly to the spirit world. And by higher plane I do not mean a higher spiritual plane, but one that cannot be observed by the ordinary physical organs of perception. In the spirit world, thought has direct and instantaneous action upon whatsoever it is directed, whether it be upon a human being or upon what on earth is called an inanimate object. I cannot use the latter term appositely in connection with spirit world objects, because all objects, all things, have life, certain and unmistakable. There is no such state as that of being lifeless in the spirit world. It is not until you come into the spirit world that you really know just what thought can do. And I do assure you, my good friend, that some of us are positively horrified when we find out for the first time. In the spirit world, thoughts do not become visible immediately upon their passing through a person's mind. They are not flying about in a loose fashion. The idle thoughts of which I spoke travel no further than your immediate earthly surroundings. Thoughts directed to some friend in the spirit world will reach that friend, and they cannot be classed as loose thoughts. Imagine to yourself the state of confusion, of congestion almost, and of embarrassment if all our thoughts in the spirit world were visible. But because they are not immediately visible, that is not to say that they are not potent, for assuredly they are very potent. No, they are not visible as you regard it, but they will unfailingly reach their destination wherever it may be. If directed towards some friend upon earth, in many cases it is problematical whether the friend will perceive them, or, perceiving them, whether he will know whence they have come. But if our thoughts be directed towards some friend in the spirit world, there will be no such doubt or uncertainty. How do we receive thoughts in the spirit world? One of the first and most interesting experiments the Truth and I carried out under the friendly eye of Edwin during our early explorations of these realms, was that of hearing Edwin speak to us from a distance. Without recounting the full circumstances, it is sufficient to say that although Edwin was in sight of us both, yet he was too far away for us to hear his voice even if he had used it above his normal tones. But we both distinctly heard his voice sounding close to our ears. At first, of course, we could not believe our ears, and we were rather inclined to regard the whole thing as some trick or other that Edwin was performing for amusement and general merriment. But he repeated his message to us. It was merely bidding us to rejoin him, and it was so unmistakable that we forthwith did as directed. As a prelude to hearing Edwin's voice, we had both perceived a bright flash to appear before the eyes. It was in no sense blinding or startling, indeed, the flash was too beautiful for that. And that, I think, describes briefly but precisely what happens to all of us when a thought is passed between one and another of us. The thought is invisible in transit. It arrives at its destination instantaneously, when it manifests itself before us as a pleasant but compelling flash of clear light, and we can then hear the voice of our communicator speaking close to the ear, as it seems. I say as it seems, because here I am not attempting to give a scientific explanation of how it happens, but confining myself solely to what does happen. The voice always sounds to me to be close to the ear, and most people here say that the same thing occurs in their own case. It may be some sort of inner perception of the voice, though to me it always sounds far too like the owner's actual voice for that. My own view is that the sound of the voice actually travels through the air, and that we receive it upon the natural apparatus of our minds. I confess that I have not looked into the matter in that deep manner that some people, perhaps, will think that I ought to have done, if only for the purpose of supplying them with a long and deep, accurate and scientific explanation of the whole process. But I am persuaded that the majority of my good friends will much rather have this frankly and obviously unscientific description of what takes place here during every second of time, just as a matter of course, than that I should lead them into some deep morass of scientific disquisition from which we should all have some difficulty in extricating ourselves. I do not profess to a knowledge of science, and I always feel that while we are peering deeply into causes and detailed explanations, we are missing all the beauties of the very thing we are examining. There is so much here that we take for granted, that is to say, we take things as they present themselves, without demanding learned explications of them. And it is the same with you who are still upon Earth. Suppose, for example, I were to ask you, supposing, also, that I did not already know, how you managed to move yourself upon your two legs in the common feat of walking. I think it would much more suit your taste for you to tell me briefly just what you did with your legs and how tired they can become after prolonged activity, than to treat me to an erudite essay upon the various muscles of the leg, their names, their shape and size, their exact mode of action, their particular function, and so on. In the meantime, while the legs were being thus dilated upon, the friend, whom the two legs were supporting, was passing through some charming country, a description of which would be so much more entertaining. And so it is with a great many other matters here, here in my world and in your world too. While science has its important place in both our worlds, yet we do not ponder every minute of our lives upon the inner working of the numberless functions of men and things that constitute life in either world. Science must have its proper position, but life would be rather dull and dreary, and certainly rather complicated, if we paused to inquire into the various modes of operation of so many common actions. We must just take things as they are. That is your general attitude upon Earth. That is our general attitude here in the spirit world. My chief purpose is to give you as many details as possible or practicable of our life in spirit lands, to state a fact as plainly as possible, to provide explanations only where necessary to an intelligent understanding of my account, and to leave it to others to probe more deeply into causes, must be my aim. When thought is directed to us from the earth, it takes the same form of a flash before the eyes. There is no difference whatever in the actual process. It matters not whence the thought has been directed, whether from your world of the earth or as an intercommunication in the spirit world. The process is universal, and there are no variations in it. When I spoke to you, a moment ago, of the thought forms you create in the ether immediately surrounding you on earth by your having idle thoughts in your mind, that must not be taken as also applying to us in the spirit world. If it did, the spirit world would be a strange place, and the people in it would appear stranger still, for they would continually seem to be enveloped either in a kind of haze of thought, forms or something even more substantial. The case is different with people on Earth. That part of the spirit world which is immediately interpenetrating your world, that is to say, the invisible world in the immediate vicinity of the particular spot, for example, where you are reading these words, this spot is not part of the realms of light. It is dark. It may have its minute patches of light in certain well-defined places, but the greater part of it is dark. Thought, of the kind that contains no evil within it, will be bright, and therefore it will show up in the surrounding gloom, just as the light of a tiny flame will illumine the gloom of a chamber from which all other eye light is excluded. Even a limited diffusion of light will be the case. But take the tiny flame into the bright light of the sun and the diffusion seems to end, the feeble light having become absorbed by the greater light of the sun. The flame will still be visible, but its light will be strictly limited to its source. This somewhat elementary analogy will serve, I hope, to illustrate the difference between thought in the invisible regions closely adjacent to your world, and thought as it is in these bright realms where I live. Even this simple analogy must be qualified by saying that however wandering may be our thoughts, they are not visible like the flame of light in the sunshine. Things are far better ordered than that in the spirit world. We do have mental privacy here. Without it, social intercourse would be trying, to say the least. We are living in a land of truth, that is certain, but we do not carry things to such an extreme that we must voice the truth openly upon all occasions. As with you, so with us, there are moments and occasions when silence is golden. But it is essential that one should learn to think properly as an inhabitant of the spirit world. One of the first things one has to do here, as a new arrival, is to think properly. It is not a difficult achievement, and not nearly so formidable a task as it may sound. It concerns one's thought about people rather than thoughts of a general nature upon things. When thought is concerned with a person, the thought, if it has sufficient force behind it, will travel to that person. If it happens to be of a pleasant or complimentary description, or of a jovial and genial nature, then the percipient will be happy to receive it. But all thoughts are not of this innocuous sort, and our mental secrets may have passed out of our minds only to have found their destination in the very last place we wanted them to be, namely, in the mind of the person of whom we were so freely thinking. The thought, however, must have a sufficient measure of directive power behind it to send it upon its journey, and this factor is the saving of many of us, because so many thoughts are mere birds of passage in our minds, and while they are there they have little really deep concentration upon the individual concerned. But the very prospect of what can happen is enough to make us keep a strict watch upon our minds. And in a brief period it becomes a second nature to us. There are many things that we have to unlearn and relearn when we first come to dwell in spirit lands, but our minds, being then free of a heavy physical brain, are at liberty to exercise their powers to the full. We are enabled, therefore, to acquire rapidly the methods of living under different conditions of existence. Our memories behave as memories should, that is to say, they are not erratic in their attentive performance, but can be relied upon to act perfectly. You can see how invaluable such an attribute will be when it becomes necessary to learn afresh how to do things according to spirit laws. It is in this rapid way that so many common actions quickly become as second nature. Although, in the spirit world, thought has such dire action and is generally so powerful, that does not mean the thought makes physical effort practically unnecessary, even undesirable. There are a great many things for our hands to do in the spirit world, and I would add that our feet also are constantly in use. We like to walk, just as we used to upon earth. What could be more natural? We are human beings after all, though some folk would deny us this characteristic. We are human, and we behave in a manner that is human. Our feet were given to us to use, and we walk upon them. Because we can create so much with our minds, because we can fabricate things by the close application of though then, it might be imagined, there is precious little left for our hands to do, except to make up our full complement of limbs and so obviate our presenting ourselves as something of monstrosities. The truth is that we use our hands in 1,000 different actions during what you would call a day's work, or during a day in our life. Think for a moment. Recall the scores of instances in which one may use their hands.